From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. Amnesty International says Australia's policy of refugee punishment will eventually compromise someone's right to life. Amnesty Pacific researcher Kate Schultz says a hunger-striking refugee detained by Australia on Papua New Guinea's Manus Island has been moved to a hospital in Port Moresby, which cannot provide adequate health care. The diabetic, hypertensive Iranian man has refused food for 3 weeks in protest over Australia's medical neglect. Kate Schultz told Dominic Godfrey Amnesty was alerted to his case on Friday afternoon of last week, and she says he needs to be brought to Australia immediately.
This person has been on hunger strike for around 20 days. He has quite a serious medical condition, which he's been told they can't adequately treat in Papua New Guinea. And instead of transferring him to Australia where he could receive that treatment, he's now being physically restrained at the hospital for 3 days. They are attempting to force feed him. He is saying that he's rejecting that treatment. And we're also concerned around reports that the medical staff have slapped him. It sounds like a pretty awful situation there. And I think one of the biggest challenges is that the healthcare system, even the Pacific International Hospital, has very limited capacity to support very serious health conditions in the country. They lack the equipment and specialist expertise, particularly when we're talking about the high levels of mental health challenges for the refugee and asylum seeker population.
So his medical condition beyond his mental state, he is physically suffering from diabetes, I understand.
Yeah, we understand that he has a number of medical conditions. He has received treatment in Australia in the past and then been returned back to Manus Island. Of course, we don't have his full medical records at this time, but we have been in direct contact with refugees speaking to that person whilst he's in hospital and restrained.
So being in Australia, having been treated for his medical condition in Australia, Australian authorities are obviously well aware of the conditions that he's facing. What would you say to the authorities there?
Well, essentially, they're aware of his medical condition. They're aware that they have the capacity to change the situation by immediately bringing him to Australia and supporting the care that he needs. But in addition, they're ultimately responsible for his fate because they're deliberately sending refugees and asylum seekers to a country that doesn't have the capacity to meet their medical needs across the board. And because of that, the responsibility and the onus is on the Australian government to ensure that they do receive adequate health care. We're in a quite desperate situation here where there were a number of people that we spoke to in Port Moresby in November last year in a very similar situation. They're waiting on medical treatment. PNG doesn't have the medical experts there who can provide ongoing treatment or the necessary specialist care that they need. So they're spending months in limbo. And I think that we need to look at the underlying causes for this person going on hunger strike. He is complaining about the poor and inadequate medical treatment that he has been receiving and all the evidence we've received in the last few days, as well as our sort of experience going there last year and talking to people at that hospital, is they're not going to have the sophisticated means to treat this person there.
They're neglecting their duty of care to this man. And it seems deliberate.
It's absolutely deliberate, and it's part of these cruel policies of punishment and deterrence. Australia is continuing to shirk its responsibility and continuing to place refugees and asylum seekers in clear and present danger, and it's only a matter of time before it's going to jeopardise someone's right to life.
The MP for Kiribati Island, where a missing ferry departed from, says many of the victims are likely to be high school students. The boat, which may have been carrying as many as 100 people, vanished after leaving an island of about 2,000 people on January the 18th. 7 survivors were found drifting in a dinghy on Sunday, and international search for others continues, but chances grow slimmer by the day. The Nanati, where the boat left the island, where the boat left from, an MP for the former Prime Minister, Sir Imanamatabi, says his constituents are both devastated and angry. He told Jamie Tahana, it appears the disaster was completely avoidable and the President's response has been far from adequate.
All he said was he was offering his support and sympathy to all those who suffered, but he ignored too many issues, as I understand it.
What did he ignore?
Well, the first one, he could not really explain why after a week when the accident happened and the government was just know of the situation only last Friday, the same day that New Zealand was asked to help. You know, it's hard to believe that with a system of government like we have, it's not good enough for the people not to know what has happened. Over a week, and they claimed they did not know about the accident. But the second one, if I can finish, he did not, because this is a tragedy that demands an independent commission of inquiry. We need to know why it happened and to be responsible. But he failed to offer that. And instead, he said he's going to get the story from his own people, the civil servant, all those people. In my view, there is a need for an independent commission of inquiry, and the government has not made a decision on that. And I think it's a major failure.
It seems this ferry had no emergency location devices or anything. It veered way off course. How is it hard to believe that the government did not know for a week?
If that is the case, but that should not have happened in the first place, because we have a marine division, we have the owners, and they should have been forced to comply with the law. Because as I understand it, they are required every vessel is meant to be seaworthy, and they should have all the necessary stuff on board to make sure the safety of the passengers are guaranteed. And it comes to light now that particular vessel did not have any of those things. It's very sad. And the government is responsible because they did not look after the situation well. They should have ensured that particular boat should not have a sail in the first place.
Yeah, you're from Nanus. Are you familiar with this ferry?
I've heard about the ferry. And that ferry, as I understand it, I have no had a ride on it. That ferry is used to take the people from my island free of charge. They don't have to pay for the thing. I understand it's part of the scheme offered by my colleague, the MP. It's catamaran, and it takes the people and the goods and whatever you. We don't have a boat here that is designed exclusively for the passengers, for the cargo. It's always a multi-purpose boat.
Have you heard from Nanus since this incident happened?
I had a visit yesterday. I had a meeting with the mayor and the chief executive officer of the council here yesterday, and we talked about it. And, it's a very sad discussion that we had yesterday with them. They're very unhappy with what happened.
How many people live on Nanus?
The last census, I believe there were more than 2,000 people.
How many are missing? Because we've had reports of it being as low as 35 and as high as 100. Do we have any idea how many people from Nanus are missing?
We still have to find out the true situation. Yeah, according to the president, he mentioned the figure 100 or 100. Other people are saying that the figures, I'm not sure, were still two figures. And I think it may take a few days to actually know how many passengers are actually on that boat. The records must have gone down with the boat as well. And, but my case, the figure of 100 is not far off. Because that's what happens. And I know that boat is too small to take that kind of number.
From what I understand, there's not much information coming out about what's happened. How are the people on Nanus doing?
I don't know, because I'm in Tarawa, and Nanus is about 1,000 miles away, and the communication by phone is bad. It's not very good. But we can assume that those who are directly affected must be very depressed. Eh? It's very bad for them now, because there are many of those who perished as students on their way to the high school in Tarawa. Because it's a new year term have to start next week, and there are many of those young kids on that boat. It's a real tragedy. If the proper procedures and the rules have been followed, one can say that it should not have happened. But I think we've been very relaxed here. We don't take the rules seriously. It's about from the government officials and the captain, the master of the boat and the owner of the boat and so on. And I think we need to change our attitude. And that's the reason why we believe also that we need an independent commission of inquiry. And we are asking government to consider that. Well, I can say that it's a real sad day for those who lost their loved ones. I know from my village, I think two or three people that I personally know that live next to in my village, and they are on that boat that perished. People on the nose are affected in a very serious way.
Health workers and provincial officials dealing with a deadly measles outbreak in Indonesia's Papua fear they could just be scratching the surface. A vaccination drive is underway, but observers say it's not a long-term solution to the region's chronic health problems. Sally Round reports.
Teams from the Papua Provincial Health Office, Indonesia's National Army and Ministry of Health have been dispatched to the district of Azmat after a measles outbreak which has killed at least 60 children. They've been inoculating people and supplying medicine and food, with an estimated 10,000 suffering from malnutrition. The Ministry of Health's Jane Supadi visited Korowai tribespeople in one of the remotest parts of the district, where she says many children had no immunity. She says the measles outbreak likely started when some of the people went to festivals in town.
Azmat is not the only district with this condition. The other district might soon have the same problem, measles outbreak and malnutrition. So the army planned to have the same mission with the other district in Papua.
Dr. Supadi says the nine-month mission has been ordered by the Indonesian president and will go into other remote areas. Andreas Hasono of Human Rights Watch says the government's moved quickly, but the death toll underscores its neglect of Papuans' basic health rights.
The question is, without a program and routine vaccination, continue vaccination, what will happen next year? What will happen years from now? I'm afraid that without a change of the government approach in the area, in Papua, it is going to be repeated over and over again.
The measles outbreak in Azmat has been exacerbated by malnutrition. Andreas Hasono says he's travelled throughout the Papua region in the past 2 decades and seen diets change for the worse. Rice and instant noodles have replaced sago and sweet potato, and traditional pork has become too expensive.
I see it all over Papua, not only in Azmat. The staple food, the diet, changed dramatically. Nowadays, I see them consuming rice. Why? Rice is dropped from the national government as their main diet.
Mr. Hasono says land where sago palm grew is being taken up for palm oil and mining. Dr. Supadi found cases of malnutrition among the Korowai people who were relying on low supplies of rice rather than the traditional sago. An executive assistant to Papua's provincial governor, Dina Ayonda, says Jakarta's committed to settling the issue, and President Joko Widodo met with the governor last week.
The president wants this issue to never happen again in Papua, because this is a big catastrophe. He asks everyone to give all the necessary help that they can do from the central government.
Ms. Ayonda says further assistance may come from the children's charity UNICEF. Meanwhile, Andreas Hasono says severe restrictions on international groups seeking access to Papua in order to help must be eased. This is Sally Round.
And you're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, coming to you from PCJ Radio International. The number of reported domestic violence cases in Cook Islands has decreased over the last 2 years, but it is still considered high. There have been efforts, including new laws, to curb the problem, but those working in the area say more needs to be done. Stella Jane Hopgood has more.
The 2014 Family Health and Safety Survey found violence against women and children is ingrained in Cook Islands society, and there are concerns that could still be the case. The Cook Islands Police reported 170 cases of domestic violence last year, just a small drop from the 185 cases reported the previous year. There was plenty of feedback on social media when the police published the latest statistics on its Facebook page.
Police need to appoint more qualified and dedicated officers in this area and work in partnership with other support agencies.
Wrist slapping must stop. Conviction must be upheld to its highest regard, or else domestic violence will continue.
The Punanang Tauturu Women's Counselling Centre has been working to eliminate violence against women for over 20 years. Coordinator Rebecca Buchanan says persistent perpetrators need help too.
What I'm finding, I guess they haven't really looked at it, but we've talked about it, where the proper assessment of the high-risk perpetrators, the ones that just happening, you know, first time, those ones can come to counselling. But there are others that keeps repeating. Those are the ones that I'm talking about that need a lot more support. Maybe there is the mental health issues, but we're not dealing with those issues.
Ms. Buchanan says there are more cases of domestic violence than police can deal with, leaving victims without the support they need.
What I see is the gaps that we are allowing to get bigger and bigger and bigger. And by not dealing with the domestic violence issues quickly and early, we are letting these people take on a lot more than they can manage.
Domestic Violence Coordinator Sergeant Sharon Kareroa says more open communication between family members would help nip abuse in the bud.
Love each other. But yeah, the messages to the public are consistent with activities of offending. So report the matter in the first instance, and speaking about abuse and gender-based violence must be a priority.
Ms. Buchanan says work and financial pressures can also add to the problem.
The domestic violence is way too high, and I'm finding it's not just the domestic violence we're talking about, it's a whole lot of things. So the inability to manage or cope with what's going on, and some of that has nothing to do with their relationship. The stress from work comes home.
The Family Protection and Support Act came into force in December, and its no-draw provision means victims can't withdraw a complaint, even if they are under pressure from extended family to do so. Sergeant Kareroa says once an incident of domestic violence is known to police, it has to progress to court.
When we prepare the file, that goes to court, and court will act on that. So the no-drop policy is when an incident is reported to the police, a domestic violence incident, we do not encourage our victims to drop their incident, so they have to do that at court.
The police are now looking into why the number of cases of domestic violence increased in the second half of the year. This is Sarah Jane Hopgood.
People around the Pacific have learned about the variety of new technologies to fight mosquito-borne illnesses. A conference in Auckland, New Zealand, that was recently held, showcased new tools to help better manage disease-carrying mosquitoes and reduce their related illnesses. Sarah Viatulu reports.
Conference speakers shared a range of new technological developments that could work well in the Pacific region. The CEO of the Zika Foundation, Michael Callahan, has worldwide experience with mosquito-borne diseases and ways to manage it, having been to many infectious zones around the world. For the Pacific, he says the main ones include malaria, chikungunya and Zika, but the most terrifying one by far is dengue.
It's a terrible disease that really hits communities at several levels. More than just a terribly painful disease, I've had it, it's no fun, that keeps you out of work for a long period of time, it also is one of the great GNP killers. It affects foreign economies quite significantly.
Currently, there's dengue in Samoa, American Samoa, Fiji, French Polynesia and Wallis and Futuna. Dr. Callahan says as well as a public health concern, it's an economic one as people aren't able to work being so sick and recovery is slow. He says the Aedes aegypti mozzie is the one to avoid being bitten by, but climate change noticeably has impacted on its life cycle.
So Aedes aegypti is the poster child as a primary beneficiary of global warming. Not just as a human adapted and goes where people go, but it particularly goes where cities are getting warmer.
The Cook Islands Ministry of Health's Valentino Wichman says he didn't realise that this disease-carrying mosquito is drawn to certain island outfits as well as odours.
Like the colouring of the clothes that you wear, the soaps that you're using, where to clean, and also where the different types of Aedes mosquito fly and which parts of the body that they're more attracted to. When you look at these behavioral factors of the mosquitoes, you can target better interventions.
Communicating key messages out to communities is also key. Mina Velayek heads up France's EPOP network that's also being piloted in New Zealand, New Caledonia, Fiji and Vanuatu. She says they target youth to seek answers to questions communities are asking, linking science, society and the media.
So they produce little videos with their smartphones because every young people, every students can have access to these technical tools now. So they use their smartphone to shoot videos, very short ones, 2 minutes max, collecting the feelings, the questions, and observation of populations facing an issue.
One new app that's been successfully piloted in other countries has huge potential for small island states. The Centres for Disease Control and Prevention's Dr. Rebecca Levine says the app just needs a mobile device and users are then given a unique barcode to log what is found in Mozzie traps. The free EpiInfo vector surveillance app can be downloaded easily.
We're really hopeful that the success that we saw in the Caribbean and Latin America with using the app can be translated to the island settings here in the Pacific.
Participants learned about a new NASA-developed GLOBAP mosquito data visualization technology and new mapping technology that utilizes drones. Attending the event were health communicators, business professionals, government officials and community leaders from countries such as Papua New Guinea, Solomon Islands, Fiji, Samoa, Niue, Cook Islands, Tonga, Republic of the Marshall Islands and the Federated States of Micronesia and Palau. The Tech Camp event was organized by the US Consulate in Auckland, with input from the University of Otago and the Secretariat of the Pacific Community. This is Sarah Waitalatu.
This past week, Nauru marked its 50th anniversary of independence. Dignitaries from around the Pacific and further afield, including from the breakaway Georgian regions of Azbisi and Osseti, have gathered on the island to take part in the celebrations. Nauru was the second Pacific Island nation to gain independence after Samoa. The colonial administrator, Australia, handed over control on January 31, 1968. And Don Wiseman asked the director of the Pacifica Center at Massey University, Malakai Kolopatangi, if it's been a good 50 years for Nauru.
I think it was initially a very good time for Nauru. In its heyday, of course, everyone knows that it was one of the most wealthiest nations in the world, even though it was very, very small. And of course, once the phosphate started to run out, infrastructure, for one, was not maintained, and the economy, of course, took a downturn. And the problem is, of course, is that Nauru really doesn't have anything except for the fish to export, and it has faced some growing political problems and instability, and it has had some constitutional support from Australia, which of course gives them the aid to Nauru that props it up. So I think initially it was a very good time in Nauru, and it was really good to be a Nauruan.
Except, of course, Nauru had access at that point, eventually, to a vast amount of money, which was squandered.
Disappeared.
Wasn't
it? It disappeared.
And it wasn't spent on facilities there.
No, it wasn't. And I mean, a good example of that, of course, was the Nauru, which is infamous in the Pacific for the mismanagement and so forth. And also, of course, Nauru had properties that it had invested in. Of course, it had to sell the properties to prop up the government. And so it's, you know, looking at the 50 years and today's celebration, I think Nauru would have to rue the opportunities that it had squandered and not really capitalized on them, because they were huge opportunities for Nauru.
What happened with the money? Was that lost through corruption or just mismanagement?
I think in a way it was probably a bit of both. Probably mismanagement of it, and such huge sums of money, and you know, per capita, for example, Nauruans were amongst the most wealthiest, not only in the Pacific, but as I said, but in the world. And so it was new. It was an opportunity that could not be managed properly, and I think Nauru would have probably done well if it was able to maybe contract investment managers and so forth to try and manage the, because there really was a huge opportunity for Nauru to maintain a standard of living that was viable and sustainable.
So is that an indication that it wasn't actually in a position to be independent because it couldn't do the job?
Yes, and I think Nauru is in that, along with some other Pacific Islands, are in that category of Pacific Islands that are impoverished and probably too small, perhaps should not be independent, but maybe should be in a status such as Tokelau and Cook Islands and Niue with regards to New Zealand. So, you know, it's always well to be politically independent, but would that be beneficially for you in terms of economics or not? That's the reality of being a small, impoverished island, being independent in such a big world.
The big question, I guess, for Nauru right now is what happens when the refugee resettlement centres, when they go, because they will go.
They will go, and of course that was, a welcome income earner, if you like, for Nauru, being a part of Australia's Pacific Solution, so-called. But that kind of thing, I see the budget this year is something like 128 million, and the expenditure is around about 127 million. So if Australia, apart from maintaining the refugee centres, if it does not give aid to Nauru, it's not going to survive. It's as simple as that.
And that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. If you want to get in touch with us to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. Once again, focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you well, saying so long, take care. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye. Yeah.